At 9 on Alternative Radio, it's part 2 of a speech from Reed College in 1995. Howard Zinn and the book that changed the consciousness of a generation, A People's History of the United States. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary, and at 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on Stage and Studio, DMAE features the last two shows of Coho Summerfest 2018, Embedded and Phillips Glass Menagerie. And at 11:30, Art Focus welcomes seminal activist and artist Danny Lyon to talk about his films Willie and Murderers, showing this month at the Hollywood Theater. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate.
KBOO hosts a monthly film series at the Clinton Street Theater called KBOO at the Clinton. This month, we'll screen the film Behemoth on Thursday, July 12th at 7 p.m. Behemoth is a Chinese documentary showing the dehumanizing impact of coal mining. After the film will be a discussion on clean energy alternatives. Again, that's a film screening of the documentary Behemoth, Thursday, July 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certifications requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The events committee meets the third Thursday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO listener members and support from Indigo Gardens, located in East Portland. Providing fresh-cut floral design for weddings, events, and personal bouquets, Indigo Gardens also offers a weekly summer bouquet CSA. More information is available by phone at 503-421-1435 and online at indigogardenspdx.com.
Good morning.
Hey, wow, the music ended.
It faded out.
Oh, it went away.
It's symbolic in some way, but I'm not
oh,
sure.
Oh, horribly symbolic.
You know, all right. No, what? Go.
Well, I just want to tell people that listen to KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial here in Portland, Oregon. This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. That's Abe Proctor. I'm Joe Uris. The number to call to talk on the air is 231-818-7. Yes. And we actually have a special guest with us in studio today. An attorney, Jason Cafori. Now, don't reach for your gun. Just because he's an attorney doesn't make it, you know.
I'm on their side, Joe.
Yeah. A lot of loose talk. And what we're going to be talking about is very important, which is a kind of embedded discrimination that has existed, I suspect, since the time that there's been commercial activity in the city and there's been persons of color. So we'll get into this.
Yeah, and not just here.
No, everywhere, probably.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's an important issue, and this is something that's going to be tried eventually.
Yes, exactly. What we're talking about exactly is a pattern of discrimination against shoppers of color in various retail establishments around Portland. Now, Mr. Cafori, who's joining us this morning, has jointly filed 6 lawsuits, is it?
We have 6 total. I think 5 were filed at the same time.
5 were filed at the same time, all revolving around this same issue. Why don't you tell us a little bit more?
Yeah. Our firm, Kafoury & McDougall, my dad, Greg Kafoury, and his law partner, Mark McDougall, we have developed a niche of handling cases where predominantly African-Americans, but some Latinos and other, Asian discrimination. We've seen it across the board. It's predominantly African-American, though. And the pattern you see is people will go shopping. The moment they walk into stores, they're greeted, meaning that someone comes up to them and asks them what they can help them with. They're then oftentimes followed around the store. And then as they exit the store, they are oftentimes asked to show proof of payment. Now, the way the law works...
Wait. I've never been asked to show proof of payment.
Joe,
I've been stealing for years.
Joe, we don't live in a fair society here. It is, and we see this. I mean, we get calls multiple times a week with this exact same pattern happening. And a few of these cases, I'll go through some of the facts on them. One, our client Jamal Winchester works today at the U.S. Postal Office. He's been a letter carrier for many years. He's got a wife and kids. He took his kids to Walmart to go buy a fishing pole to go fishing. And he bought the pole. He was walking out with the pole, and he was stopped and asked to show his receipt. And he said, you know what? I just bought this. I just walked out. I didn't steal it. I don't have to show you my receipt. And the truth is, he doesn't have to show his receipt. You don't have a right to ask people randomly to show their receipts just because you have suspicion that they might have tried to stolen something. And so he had every right to say, no, I won't show you that receipt. And all of a sudden, they accuse him of being a thief. They say, people like you steal here. Mm. She said that to him. They started cussing at him. And fortunately, his daughter pulled out a cell phone camera and captured a lot of what happened. So we have a video of what happened to him. And we then had a shopper go on video and go through the store, walk out, and nothing happened to the shopper. And that shopper was white, had the exact same fishing pole. We did the same experiment four times at four different exits, and nothing ever happened to that shopper as they walked out white. In fact, they looked at the greeter, nodded, and walked right out with their fishing pole. So what we're doing with this case at Walmart is we are demanding Walmart produce 90 days worth of every exit that's happened before Mr. Winchester's incident. And if we then can show a pattern that they are stopping African-Americans at a higher rate than other people, they're in for an incredibly large amount of punitive damages. That's the way we view it, if we can show a pattern.
So the implication is really that these are not random stops at all. There's a common factor here, and that's discrimination against people of color.
The moment you allow discretion of that person who's standing by the exit, that meaning they can size that person up who's coming out and decide yes or no, I'm going to decide whether to ask receipts or check for proof of payment, you are inviting internal racism in that person's mind to come into play. And that's what's happened. Now, as an example, Costco, I believe, has a policy which says that every single person that walks out the door, no matter what your color or your race is, has to show a receipt. That's a policy that I think is legal if everybody has to do by it. But the moment you have randomness to it, then you're inviting racism. Hmm.
All right. We're also joined in studio by one of your clients.
Yes.
Forgive me in advance if I mispronounce your name. Naisrael?
Yeah, Naisrael.
Hey, all right. Naisrael Saley, who's a senior at Jefferson High. You're co-captain of the cheer team there, and you're on your way next year to attend the University of Oregon on a full scholarship to study sports medicine. And you are one of Mr. Kafoury's clients, is that right?
Yes.
Can you describe to us what happened to you?
So me and my friend Khalil happened to stop by at Sunglass Hut on my way, just to spare some time before I went off to this Nike program that I'm doing through SCI. We were in Sunglass Hut around 4 o'clock, 3
o'clock. Wait, this is at Lloyd Center?
Yes, this is at Lloyd Center.
Okay.
And just to clarify, her friend Khalil Chapman was the star basketball player at Jefferson High School A few weeks after this incident, he scored over 30 points in the state championship game and has full rides all over. So, I mean, this is a both her and he are powerful young people in our community, and this is how they were treated.
Yeah, so we were in there for about 5 minutes. There was a sales associate. I don't quite remember her name, but I know she was looking at us for a while. We didn't see anything that we liked, so we just walked out. We went inside two different stores. The last store that we went to was H&M. Khalil was on the opposite side of the store, and that's when a manager approached me. I didn't know he was the manager at the time, but he was running up the stairs, and he came up to me. He was like, "Who has the glasses?"
A manager from the Sunglass Hut had gone two stores over and tracked these people down.
It's a determined manager.
Yeah, I was like, "What are you talking about?" He was like, "Who has the glasses? One of you guys stole the glasses." I was like, "Well, I don't have any glasses. I don't know what you're talking about." So he then approached Khalil on the other side of the store, and I followed him. He asked Khalil the same questions, and Khalil was like, "I don't know what you're talking about." He emptied out his pockets, took out his phone and his keys, and was like, "I don't have any glasses." He was like, "Well, security should be here any minute." And I was like, "Well, we didn't take any glasses." He was like, "We have you on footage." And we're like, "Well, can we go see this footage?" So we then follow him back to the store, and the security was waiting outside for us. And Khalil asked the sales associate who accused us of stealing. He said, "So what's going on now?" And the lady then said that we stole glasses because there was a missing pair of glasses where some type of hole was supposed to be at, like glasses were supposed to be inside of a hole. And she said when we left, they weren't there anymore. And then the manager just started apologizing. He was like, "Oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. We had moved them this morning, and I just forgot to tell you." So me and Khalil just looked at each other and were just like, "Wow," or like, "Are you serious?" And we said that we'd come back with the proper authorities, you know, meeting our parents, and we had just walked out, and then we called our parents.
And this is an unbelievable typical what they do. They say, "Oh, we've got you on video footage. That is there. You know, you just need to admit you've done this." They don't actually have them on video footage. And it's a bad false arrest stop. It's illegal unless you have the five elements. You have to show that you have to watch the person enter the store. You have to watch them in the entire time they're in the store. You have to watch them take the item. You have to watch them conceal the item. And you have to watch them go out the exit without going by any of the pay places. That's the five elements of loss prevention. And this idea that you can have suspicion that maybe that's the person who did something, that's racist. And it's a false arrest.
So you have to witness an actual theft.
You have to witness an actual theft, yeah, or you don't have probable cause to stop somebody.
So in essence, what you're arguing is it's shopping while a person of color.
Yes. Yeah, that's exactly what it is. And you know, I don't know how you'd like to comment on this, but I assume this is something that, as an African American young person in their late teens, that when you go shopping, this is something that you have to deal with.
Yeah, so you know, growing up as a young African American woman in the whitest city in America, you know, I already feel out of place. But when I walk into a store, sometimes I feel like all eyes are on me, especially if I'm the only person of color inside the store. You know, and I kind of find it insulting that people judge me based on the color of my skin, that I can't, you know, make a purchase or that I'm there to steal. You know, it gets uncomfortable. Nobody should have to feel like that as they're browsing the store, if they're trying to shop like everybody else.
Yeah, you're there to give them some of your hard-earned money.
Right.
Yeah, you deserve at least a little bit of courtesy.
Yes.
Now, you feeling like these conditions are magnified based on the demographics of Portland, because we're such a white city, mm-hmm. that this sort of thing stands out all the more. Mm-hmm. That's your feeling?
Yes.
Now, is this something that's experienced by your friends, members of your peer group?
I'm not quite sure, you know, their stories, but I know everybody experiences it. I think that people just kind of learn how to live with it, even though it shouldn't be like that. People know it's there.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, you know, I just get it through several different sources. It's not just the big shopping areas. You know, it's also our Portland police. You know, when you talk to an African-American young man in his 20s and you say, "How often are you stopped by the Portland police?" You look at the stats of how often Portland police, especially the gang task force, how often they pull over African-Americans versus Caucasian people. It's stunning. It's stunning. And this type of, you know, demographic, you know, because of the color of your skin, is something that we in Portland, we as citizens, we don't want to believe it. That's what I find. You know, when we actually go to court and we take these cases to trial, and we've done probably six or seven trials in the last 8 years involving, you know, sort of shopping while black cases, or we've done even more than that, involving discrimination with the police. When we take them to court, the jurors will oftentimes say, yeah, that was a false arrest. Yeah, that was a battery. They shouldn't have done it. They didn't have probable cause to stop this person. But it's much harder for that juror to say, but it was because of the color of the skin that that happened. It's much harder to win on a discrimination claim in the city. And it's because we Portlanders don't want to believe in this progressive hub of America that, that we have racism.
But we have bicycles.
We have bicycles too, Joe.
I mean, okay. I'm sorry. I'm in a very irrelevant mood. I'm very depressed about a lot of things today. Supreme Court choice, a proposed choice, a lot of stuff. ICE not being able to reunite children with their parents. A lot of stuff also relevant to persons of color and relevant to persons who were born somewhere else.
But let me say one thing, Joe, that I, in these dark, dreary national political times, I think it's all the more important to focus on making Portland the best city that it can be and making Portland a model for the country. And these suits, I will tell you, they change behavior. I'll tell you a story. My dad had a case against Fred Meyer in the 90s, and it was the same kind of a situation. It was a random policy Fred Meyer had of checking people's receipts, and it turned out that they would check African-Americans' receipts much in a much higher percentage. And he hit Fred Meyer for hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars in punitive punishment damages back in the 90s. And for the last 10, 15 years, we almost never get a phone call at our office because somebody was racially profiled at Fred Meyer's. And in fact, Fred Meyer has a policy in their internal manual, which says, you know, if you don't have these elements, you don't stop people. We changed corporate behavior just because of those cases.
So these kinds of actions, these kinds of lawsuits have real and measurable effects and make, and I'm oversimplifying here, make the shopping experience more fair and less discriminatory for people.
I think absolutely a change. The only way to stop a corporation from doing stuff is to challenge them. And if the government's not stopping them and the media can't stop them, the court system and the only thing that they understand is dollars and cents, then having to pay money is how you change corporate behavior.
Can I ask you how many, can you name some of these corporations? Because I understand they're small and large.
Sure, yeah. In this latest round, we sued Nike.
Nike, the sacred cow?
Nike, the sacred cow, yes. They accused... I believe he was Filipino. He was a very dark-skinned Filipino man of theft. He works at the U.S. Postal Office. He's worked there for 12 years. Just a nice, quiet guy. And he brought in something to exchange at the Nike downtown store, exchanged the item, left, was out on the public sidewalk blocks away. All of a sudden, police swarm him, detain him, accuse him of being a thief. The police take him back to the store and detain him there for many minutes. And it wasn't until they looked back and figured out that on his phone he had the receipt for when he'd originally purchased the item that they let him go. But that just wouldn't, Joe, that just wouldn't happen to you. That's the truth about it, is you went into Nike and exchanged something, no police are going to swarm you. And that's what Portlanders have to understand. Color of your skin does make a huge difference in our city.
You are shifty looking, but I think he's right.
Yeah, kind of an old sleazy guy.
Yeah, that's exactly right. All right, this is KBOO 90.7 FM on your radio dial. This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio program. We're joined in studio today by attorney Jason Kafoury and one of his clients. I'm going to try your name once again. Nyasrael.
Yeah,
Nyasrael. Nyasrael Saleh. They are part of a series of lawsuits that has been jointly filed alleging repeated incidents of racially based discrimination in Portland retail outlets. You can give us a call, 503-231-8187. You can also reach us on the Facebook page. That's facebook.com/Abe and Joe, or over the Twitter machine at Honest Abe 72. Go ahead.
Well, this, if I understand what you're saying, it's a fairly common behavior on the part of store security. Is that right?
Based on the phone calls we get, I had two calls yesterday.
Really?
Totally, people that didn't know each other at all. Two phone calls yesterday, both involving a convenience store, which I guess has video poker, called Dottie's.
Oh, Dottie's. That's a fake place. It's all about gambling.
Yeah. It's basically a video poker. And I had two people contact me out of the blue yesterday about the same store out on 181st and Gleason. And both African-American, one was Somali and the other African-American, and both of them were claiming discrimination at the same Dottie's. I mean, what's the chance that that's going to happen in the same day with two random people, right? All within activities in the last couple of months. So, and I will tell you, the incident at Sunglass Hut, if you do some searching around, Sunglass Hut has been hit for discrimination in other lawsuits. This is not the only time. And I know of some other lawsuits or potential lawsuits in the mix here in Oregon involving Sunglass Hut also.
So it appears that the company may not only be racist, but incompetent.
What element of it is incompetence? The truth is, at the corporate level, they need to change behavior. And the way you do that is you implement a very solid policy. And if people aren't following the policy, you fire them. I mean, that's the way that corporations need to act in these situations.
All right, we've got some callers who want to join the conversation. Let's go to the phones. Cody, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Great show. I got 2 points. First point is that I take my hat off to any lawyer who deals with discrimination cases because most lawyers don't touch them. And they haven't touched them, I guess, because they're not moneymakers, or at least they don't appear to be moneymakers. And I applaud any lawyer that actively handles discrimination cases to this degree, and they're bringing attention to the unmitigated hypocrisy that a liberal city who claims to be liberal and anti-Trump, you know, it should be exposed. Great job. My second point is this person of color thing and how it's watered down the truth of what's happening to the descendant of slave population, black people in the United States, with American rights and with full American rights, and who died for their voting rights and who went through so much. Let's just forget slavery for a hot split minute and deal with Reconstruction right on up to being denied FHA loans for fighting in World War II, right on up to how these FHA loans affected our neighborhoods, to the redlining, to the gentrification that we have today. And not Asians or Filipino or other brown people, but an African Americans, full American citizens who can trace their lineage back clear to the 1700s, that is being treated this way, and how this person of color is so deceptive, because everyone else is watering down and basically negating the African American experience in this country and what they've had to deal with politically and economically, which both of them, by the way, go together. All right. And this person of color thing, especially in KBOO and Portland and on the progressive side, we need more descriptive labels, because I don't hear other persons of color who does not fit the African American demographic being shot and killed over minor traffic violations at the rate that African Americans, descendants of slaves, full American citizens who are still dealing with this insanity in a left-leaning progressive city like Portland, Oregon. I have a lot of black friends who are complaining about being followed in these stores, and it's ridiculous. And I'm glad we have a show. I'm glad you're having a show about it. And I'm happy that attention is being brought to this, because I'm seeing the irony and the paradoxes that are going on. And I can only just say it's hypocrisy, and maybe people are being manipulated at the political level and at some level about how certain areas are kumbaya, and they're not. So thanks a lot for your time.
Yeah, thank you.
Appreciate the call.
I don't want to use up any more of your airtime. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, sir.
You know, anyone who really studies the history of Oregon can see not only a pattern, but a sheer obviousness of a prejudice and discrimination. Remember, this state, at its foundation in 1859, voted to exclude persons of color, African-Americans specifically, and in fact had laws that if such a person stayed more than a certain amount of time, I think it was a year, they could be whipped and driven out of the state. In fact, I know people, older people, who have to find a place to stay if they're going into Eastern Oregon. It's dangerous, really dangerous, for a black person to travel and seek a shelter in many parts of the state. This was true a few years ago, and I found out that it's not untrue now.
Well, they also had the sundown laws, right, in Medford?
Yes.
Right? As recently as the 60s, where if
yeah,
you were
Medford
African-American,
and
you could not be out after
yeah,
sundown.
Yeah, many parts of Southern Oregon, this was true.
Yeah. And it was only, I want to say, in the 1990s, thanks to former state senator Margaret Carter, that discriminatory language was removed from the state constitution.
That's right.
We're talking about, you know, we've really only addressed this in absolute terms, or beginning to, in the fairly recent past.
You know, I think one thing that's really changed the discussion is how quickly information can move on the social media, too. I mean, you look at what happened with the two African-American guys at the Starbucks. I think it was out in Philadelphia where, you know, they're just sitting there and all of a sudden they're, you know, told to leave for no particular reason. It's a public place. And all of a sudden that went so viral all over the internet. Everybody heard about it. And suddenly the CEO of Starbucks has to come out and make statements and apologize and do that.
Well, even closing for half a day, I believe, to teach people
behavior. Right. So I think that having these conversations is critical because we in Portland need to recognize and we need to hear from people of color about what their day-to-day experiences are like. And, you know, it's like the Portland police. 70% of the Portland police don't live in the city of Portland. They do not reside here. They do not interact here. And, you know, we need to have a lot more conversations between people of authority, you know, the store owners, managers, and people of color, and have those dialogues. I really believe that.
I was just having a similar conversation the other day where somebody said, I can't believe all these acts of discrimination that are suddenly happening. And I was like, no, we just have the means to document them now. You know, and I hope, Nasriel, that you and your friends are carrying your smartphones with you everywhere you go, and
yes,
you're ready to whip
definitely.
Them out and document. Because the more this stuff gets out, you know, the more we start to peck away at that barrier that you were talking about earlier, Jason, this reluctance that people of the great enlightened Portland you don't want to admit about what's going on in their own city. And I think that reluctance is a byproduct of the privilege that white people enjoy every moment of every day here in the United States of America. So the more actual evidence that we can lay on the table, like the evidence presented in your lawsuits, you know, the closer we are to making sure this sort of thing doesn't happen anymore.
Well, and I think there's another element here. Portland, aside from the fact that it constitutionally excluded persons of color, actually created a system of redlining that was one of the harshest in the country. African-Americans were relegated in the modern times, first to Vanport and to small parts of Portland, and then to the Albina neighborhood. Then systematically, that neighborhood was carved up. The Memorial Coliseum, the I-5 freeway, the Model Cities program, the program at Emmanuel Hospital, all of which moved that community, destroyed people's homes. Many people who were successful, hardworking people who owned their own homes were forced to move and now live in what are called the numbers. This is a real thing. Communities were really broken up, particularly communities that are built around churches were very, very harshly treated and suffered serious consequences. And now the city is sort of acknowledging it with a kind of right of return project, which is unclear to me, and I don't know that anyone's going to take them up on it because you can't go back. You walk down Williams Avenue. It ain't the same. You know, I used to live there. It ain't the same.
No.
It's
no.
just not.
And you've also got a situation around Jefferson High School where so many African-American families have been displaced to the eastern part of the county. But you see them come back on Sundays to go to church in the same old neighborhood. And it's simultaneously a beautiful thing that's been kept alive, but simultaneously so sad. It's just heartbreaking the way that neighborhood has changed in just the last 10, 20 years.
Yeah, well, I grew up in Irvington. I'm not a couple blocks away from Joe, actually. I went to Irvington grade school and you know, just watching the demographics change, I think that Irvington was around 50% African-American when I was there. And 10 years later, when my brother was there, it was down to like 20%. I mean, just like that. That's, you know, from the 80s to the 90s. So that's how it started.
All right, let's take care of a little biz and we'll go back to the phones. Coming up today on KBOO at 9 on Alternative Radio, it's part two of a speech from Reed College in 1995, Howard Zinn and the book that changed the consciousness of a generation, A People's History of the United States. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, Stage and Studio features the last two shows of Coho Summerfest 2018, Embedded and Phillips Glass Menagerie. And finally, at 11:30, at Art Focus welcomes seminal activist and artist Danny Lyon to talk about his films Willie and Murderers, showing this month at the Hollywood Theater. All this and more coming up today on your community-supported radio station, KBOO. Let's go back to the phones.
Yeah, 231-8187.
Helen, you're next. Good morning.
Okay. I want to say this is not about black people, but this is what my experience that I have been having at Walmart, but actually in McMinnville. They passed a law that people could not have plastic bags anymore, but they would have to charge for any bag in a store, like a brown bag. And some people kicking and screaming about it, like Walmart in McMinnville. Like, they said, well, these stores aren't doing it, so we shouldn't have to either, so don't bother with this law. So when I was in on Friday, the main manager was gone, so there's these other people in there who are supposed to be managing, but they don't exactly know what they're doing. Then what I did is I went over to get my pictures that I had made, and that same lady who was supposed manager came over and said, there's some pictures you can't have. Well, first of all, they're copyright. And then, like, what? Well, you know, they're from Willamette Week. You know, I could call Willamette Week. Well, they were the naked pictures. And you can't print any naked picture. Say, well, this is Portland. All these naked people were out. There was in the newspaper. What are we talking about?
Well, wait, Helen, I appreciate your story. And it's certainly interesting. And you're probably right to be outraged. But I'm not sure where it's on point
okay,
here.
Okay. Just a minute. So then what I did, I was really pissed about this, and actually I did call up to corporate, and the guy could help me. You can't go too far up in corporate. And I say, you want to make a law about one thing that you can't do, but you are not following a law about something else. You know, that is not right. It shouldn't be that they can decide they can do this or that. It doesn't matter, but we as citizens have to follow this other law.
Okay, thank you for the call.
Thank you very much for the call. Sally, you're next. Good morning.
Yes, I have a question because it is my understanding that unlawful arrests are not against the law. And if I'm incorrect, what is the ORS number that makes an unlawful arrest have legal teeth in a defense?
Well, I'm not sure exactly. So you got different standards here. There's criminal standard and then there's a civil standard.
Criminal.
Okay. What we're talking about here today are civil cases.
If you're in a store and you don't have, you know, and they arrest you for, you know, they decide to arrest you because they decide you've stolen, then that becomes.
So here's the way the law works in stores. Shopkeepers have a specific law. I can't cite you the ORS right now on it, but it's called the shopkeeper's rights or law, something along those lines. Anyway, what it means is the shopkeepers, if they have reasonable suspicion, they can stop you and detain you in a reasonable manner for a reasonable amount of time. And that becomes up to a jury. Was it reasonable to stop someone for 10 seconds to check their receipt versus 20 minutes to and call cops and all that sort of stuff? So it has to be a reasonable time and a reasonable manner. But that is the shopkeeper's defense. If you're walking out of a store, is that they do have a right to stop you and have a reasonable detention. Where it becomes unreasonable is if they have no probable cause initially to stop you, meaning they haven't seen you conceal it, they haven't seen you walk out the door and go through all the elements, or if they've lost sight of you throughout the store, that also takes away what I would say, is there reasonable suspicion to stop and detain you? So that's how it works. And that's the same. And under criminal, obviously, if they go through that and it turns out that you have the item, well, yeah, then they have probable cause to call law enforcement or to detain you. And they can, at that point, if you have the item, you know, physically detain you and grab you. And you know, as long as they do that in a reasonable manner, they don't do it, you know, to a point where it's a battery. So.
So an unlawful, I'm making it very clear, unlawful arrest. There's no ORS to make that unlawful.
I mean, I've walked you through what's lawful and what's not lawful.
Right,
so,
but is there, if it's unlawful, you know, you said,
it's
well,
unlawful.
If somebody has the item and they, you know, detain you or charge you or whatever, is there any protection, ORS protection, when it goes to the point of criminal, in whatever reason, that an unlawful arrest can have a teeth in a legal defense? Because it's my understanding there's no ORS. They say you can't have an unlawful arrest, but there's no ORS to have teeth to make an unlawful arrest have, you know, protection.
I feel like we're splitting hairs.
Yeah, I mean, we are splitting hairs. It's unlawful if you're detained without probable cause and if it's not done in a reasonable time in a reasonable manner. I mean,
I think it's important to understand there's a whole question of unlawful imprisonment here.
Yeah.
And where that is something for a jury to decide.
That's exactly right. Ultimately, it comes down to the jurors, and there's a lot of factors at play. How many minutes were involved? Were you grabbed? You know,
Were you insulted? Were you humiliated? All kinds of things.
Yeah.
All right, let's go back to the phones. I think Camillo is next. Good morning.
Good morning. I want to speak about the phone conversation from what I believe was who I believe was an African American man who objected to the term people of color. Now, you can correct me if I didn't hear this correctly, but it seemed like he said that African Americans are somewhat annoyed with the term people of color because it's been African American.
Well, I think he was annoyed. I don't think he was speaking for a people. Let's be clear about this. This is his position, and it's a valid position to argue, but it isn't necessarily one that everyone would share.
Well, I think that you should have challenged him on it.
Well,
considering
why?
The kind of discrimination that Native Americans, Mexicans, and Chinese have had in this state, as well as others.
Yes, but it's not necessarily our job to police language all the time. you know, he expressed his opinion on the term, and, you know, that was that.
Okay, well, I'll express my opinion then.
All right.
I think he did say that other African Americans object to this term. I believe I heard that.
Well, that may be true. We don't know that.
Well, that's what I recall. But
no, I'm saying we don't know how other people feel. We haven't done any survey research. The question, by the way, the question is sort of, well, let me finish. The question is sort of irrelevant here. One of the things I've always believed is that a community, which is identified as a community specifically based on appearance, has a right to define how it will be named. And I have to say, let me finish. This is important. I have to say that the terminology used by persons of color in America has changed. I can remember, and I'm pretty old, I can remember when my parents had an argument with an African-American friend about the question of whether or not the word colored was appropriate to use for African-Americans. They said Negro at that time. This was the 1940s, that long ago.
Oh, you're missing the point that I'm trying to make.
I guess I am.
You haven't allowed me to make it, so I'm going to make it now, please.
Okay.
So what I understand is that he was objecting to the use of this term because African Americans have suffered worse than other people of color. And I want to make the point that this is a big mistake to adopt such an attitude at a time when we all need to support one another and we're facing the same kind of discrimination by the structures that are interfering with the rights of all people of color.
Okay.
That's all I'm trying to say.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you for the call.
Appreciate that. Juan, you're next.
He dropped.
Oh. Well, we'll get back to Juan if we can.
Okay. Are we free?
Yeah, we are.
We are free. Okay. Well, I mean, it's difficult for, particularly for the newer arrivals to this city. We have a transition taking place where our city is getting.
We got hundreds of thousands of people that live here that are not from originally from Portland.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of the right term. I don't like the insulting terms that are used by old timers, and at any rate, the great bulk of those people are persons who are of Caucasian descent. The thing that is obvious to me is that there's no real historical understanding of what has happened in this state and in this city. Once you really see the pattern of discrimination and forced movement and so on that has been a part of the lives of persons, I'm going to say this, I think it's a good term for all people whose skin is not pale like mine, persons of color. And the thing is that there's no question about it. And it doesn't just have to do with obvious stuff. It is, in fact, it goes beyond the days back in the 40s and 50s when black people couldn't be served downtown at all. It goes beyond that. It's subtle, but it's also not so subtle. And right now, what Kefouri's argument is and what the legal cases will display is a pattern of assumption that people, because of their appearance, are more prone to common crimes. It might even be, let's conceivably say it, a statistical truth. It's not relevant to the individual cases as they appear. Any decision made by a authority, a store owner, a manager, or the police to detain a person based on the fact of how they appear is and should be illegal and unwarranted and wrong. And that's really where this is all at.
Yeah, and I will add that, anecdotally, from the phone calls and what we hear at our office, because I think we are sort of the preeminent place to come if you feel like you've been discriminated against, especially while shopping, is that, our city is 7% African-American, 6 or 7% African-American. Our state is, 2%,
3%? Yeah, something like that.
And as my client pointed out earlier, we are the whitest major city in America. And we get the vast majority of the calls are African-Americans that have been discriminated against. So, yes, I think all people of color are discriminated against in our city, but I would put it upwards of 80 to 85% of the calls that we get are based on folks that are being targeted shopping while black. And let me throw out one of the other pieces of this case. It's not just shopping in major stores. It's also, we've had a couple cases like this recently, major places telling African-Americans they have to prepay for their food. And we had this case.
Is this in like restaurants?
Restaurants, yeah.
Really?
Yeah. So my clients, there was two African-American young men. They were with two light-skinned females. The server came up, and it was at a Red Robin out in Gresham. And this just happened about 6-7 months ago. And they agreed to serve the lighter-skinned women food, but they asked the African-American men to prepay for their food. And the African-American men said, what are you talking about?
This is a regular restaurant.
This is a regular restaurant. What are you talking about, prepay for my food? And they said, oh, well, you guys were in here. You two were in here, weeks ago, and you didn't pay for your food. And we know it was you and why we have you on video again.
Well, wait, now, to be fair, all African-Americans look alike to white people.
What I'm curious about, Nasriel, and I want to ask you for a moment to represent your entire peer group, so no pressure here. Is this sort of thing, this pattern of repeated discrimination, which, as Jason describes, is too big to miss at this point, is this something that you that your peers are aware of and that they're fired up about?
Yeah, they're aware about it. I feel like people need to start being more considerate of what's going on in the world. Everything right now that's happening with black men being shot, people being accused, you would think that people would take those stuff into consideration, because what would have happened if me and Khalil would have handled the situation differently? Mm-hmm. Like Jason said, right now I am on a tuition. My tuition's being paid for right now, and Khalil's on a full ride scholarship. So say we would have handled things differently. What if we would have got charged for something? My life could have took a totally different turn.
Yeah, that's right. What if you had reacted angrily,
right,
which you had every right to do? You would not have enjoyed a privileged response to that.
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah, I commend you for stepping forward with this lawsuit.
I think it might be helpful for the listeners just to talk a little bit about how it felt to have worked so hard to succeed in our city, and yet feel at that moment that you'd been targeted because of the color of your skin.
It was very embarrassing. I was very humiliated at the time. That's never happened to me before, so I wasn't quite sure how to handle it. But, you know, I handled it the right way. Thank God. I don't think anyone should ever have to experience that. They should be able to walk around and shop or browse or do whatever and feel comfortable and be treated like everybody else.
And I have a lot of clients now that are totally petrified of going into stores. I mean, after they've had a bad experience, and they literally go into stores and they look around and they see where the cameras are and they see where the people are and they don't go browse. They don't go browse anymore. What they do is they go in for their one item, they grab the one item and they walk out of the store because they're so scared that if they're walking around and spending too much time in the store, they're going to start getting followed and they're going to start. We had this one case against H&M. You know, video is so powerful. But this case was made by the video. And we had an African-American woman, Brenda Moaning. She was shopping. She's in her 50s, big church-going young woman. And she was one of the only African-American people. I think she was the only African-American person in this huge H&M store. And the video camera zeroes in on her. We got the video afterward. And the security guys watched her go around the entire store for minutes, watched just her going around the entire store. She went up and exchanged, paid for items, and as she left, was then stopped, detained, grabbed, taken to the back room. And we got the video, and we showed it to the jurors, and the jurors agreed that it was a false arrest. It was agreed that it was a battery, but they couldn't get to discrimination. We asked them why afterwards. We said, what else do you need? She's the only African-American. She's being the only one followed in the store. And yet the jurors just didn't want to believe, like I said earlier, that the city could have discrimination.
Wait, I have a great idea. Yeah. I have a great idea for making money. What we need is a couple of African-Americans to walk around doing nothing. Just walk around and I'll steal all the stuff.
But this sounds, I mean, that's got to be exhausting. An exhausting way to live, to walk around with that weight, knowing that at any moment your motives might be questioned just because you happen to be acting like everybody else. I think it's hard. I think it's hard as a white person to imagine what that must feel like on a day in, day out basis. And the fact is that I will never know. And none of the rest of us in this room will ever know what that feels like.
My point is exactly that. I have, as it happens, a white skin privilege, though I look like hell. It's true. Yeah, it's true. I'm an ugly guy. The fact of the matter is that I enjoy a certain privilege, which I generally accept it. It's nothing I have anything to do with. Even scruffier or dirtier than I might be, I will not be treated the same way as a person with a dark skin. It's just true.
But I will say, you know, again, changing corporate behavior. That Brenda Moaning case, after we won the verdict, the jurors hit them for, I think, $110,000, including some of it as punitive damages, punishment. That went so viral because we had the video and on social media, this is about 4 or 5 years ago, that the head of H&M out of, you know, Switzerland or Sweden or wherever the heck they are, had to put out a public statement about our particular lawsuit in Portland, Oregon, saying that H&M is gonna make a policy that is not discriminated against African Americans. So, you know, when you're reaching the CEO just by going to court, it's why this process is so important. It's why, you know, we work hard to shed publicity and shed light on these cases. You know, we could file these on a Friday afternoon at 5 o'clock and never tip off any of the media about it, but we purposely tip off the media because we want to get attention drawn to this because, you know, we're social justice advocates as much as we are lawyers at our law firm.
Well, it sounds like you're doing well by doing good.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're punching through the blinders of privilege to get white people to acknowledge the world as it is, really.
Yeah.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Linda, good morning.
Hi. Hi. Thank you, Joe and Abe, for the show, and especially thank you for the young woman who came on. I didn't get on early enough to hear her name clearly, but thank you to her and to her attorney. I wanted to tell a story because it seemed like many of the callers weren't talking to the point. And I had a very close friend who died in 2014, but I first met her back in the early 80s, and she and I would go shopping together and, you know, go to events and do lots of things together. And she was one of those people that everybody kind of loved and wanted to go up and give a big hug to, even though she didn't remember knowing them. But nonetheless, she dressed up extra special whenever we went to those kinds of stores, especially at that time. I think it was called Meyer and Frank's, not Macy's, and Nordstrom were in the Lloyd Center Mall, which were our neighborhood mall. And it was, you know, she just educated me to it was because she got followed around. And she was a professional social worker, and she looked professional in her appearance and dress, but she had to make sure that she extra dressed up to go to the store. She also did it when she went to doctors. She found that doctors did not treat you the same if you came in on a weekend really sick in your sweats. So she would even, no matter how sick she was, she'd have people help her get dressed up well enough so that she could go to the doctor. And I remember when going to visit her in a recovery place, you know, one of those rehab recoveries after you've had chemo or surgery. And she seemed to know everybody who worked there by name. And so I said, do you really know him and his grandkids? You've only been here a week. And she said, Linda, these are the people who care for me. I have learned how I have to behave to make sure that in the middle of the night I get the care I need. And so I'm using all of those examples just to say that it's deeply through Portland, and people who have been experiencing this and raising their kids experiencing this for ever. And we as white people really, 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 we don't have to each have an individual friend who will help us understand and see the racism that she faced every day, but we need to purposely want to wake ourselves up to this, to see it in the housing discrimination. I had another friend who, she had a voice that people interpreted as black, so when she called for apartments, she could never get any. And so we tried to game, she and I would call one apartment, and then she would call it. The answers would be, sure, come on by, fill out an application. No, sorry. Already taken. You can guess who got which answer.
Sure. And I can add,
that was a powerful story.
Right.
I can add to that. Back in the late 60s, I did some work here with several black organizations. And what we did was I would be incredibly scruffy dressed and not at all.
Much like today.
Much like today. Yeah, just sort of looking like hell.
Just Tuesday morning outfit.
Yeah, right. And I would go with a white woman, and we would look at a place, and people were very friendly. We would also have at the same time before us, actually a little before us, a very well-dressed, well-presented, well-represented in terms of jobs and security and so on, African-American couple. And inevitably, and this was in a transition stage in the Irvington neighborhood, inevitably the place had already been rented when the black people showed up. And when we showed up, and we did not look good, they were quite willing to rent to us. So it's obviously discrimination. It's obviously
and
the case.
Joe, what I want to say is so many people who I consider good people, when you tell them stories like that, they want to start making up reasons for why the landlord wasn't really racist or why somebody didn't really mean that in a racist manner. And that's the thing I also think is so disturbing, and you brought that up earlier, is that the denial, and I don't think it's just that there are so few black people in this city and so many white people. I'm not sure that same kind of denial doesn't take place in a suburb outside of say Houston, where the demographics would be really different. And so there's something about that refusal to recognize what's happening to people, even when you consider yourself an objective and open person, is a real problem among white people.
Yeah, I will say that was a really great point. And I think the stories are more powerful than the generalizations. I really do. I will say that how my clients are dressed has a huge determining factor of what happens. I had a client who worked at Wieden and Kennedy, and she was on a Max. And she saw a young African-American guy getting hassled by the Max police. And she got out and demanded that they give the business card. She wanted the cop's business card. And she was adamant. But she was in a hoodie and she had her hat sideways. And next thing she knows, she is grabbed by this police officer, slammed down over the garbage can, handcuffed, and taken to jail. For what? asking for a business card.
Wow.
And it was because it was how she was dressed. I guarantee it that he would have politely, I don't know if it meant that politely, but he probably would have handed her a business card if she was in her, you know, church Sunday best outfit. And, you know, he didn't know she worked at Wieden & Kennedy. And one of my favorite parts about that story is her name was Shamika Owens, Shamika Newman at the time. She sang gospel songs in the police car all the way to the police station.
But this question of denial that we keep coming across, you described it in terms of the jury unable to, you know, to make that leap to discrimination when it wasn't a leap at all. It was laid out for them. And what the caller just mentioned, I mean, that's a big problem. And again, it comes back to white people living in conditions of privilege for their whole life. When you live in a system that is designed to make you succeed, and when you operate in it every day, you want two things become clear. First, you want to believe that it is a just and fair system. And so when you're confronted with evidence that it isn't, your instinct is to push back on that and say, well, no, they're not really racist, or no, this store wasn't really trying to discriminate. And it's making that break and challenging the conditions of privilege in which they live that is so hard for so many white people.
Well, and it's called cognitive dissonance.
Cognitive dissonance, exactly.
It's well recognized in the social sciences. So it's not a new discovery. But what we're seeing is a society that more and more pretends that all of the old issues have gone away, when in fact, sadly, they have not.
I will say one thing. I do want to point this out because I believe it. I think the Portland police have gotten a little bit better, believe it or not. I think that all of the feds coming in and having to force the superiors to come in when there's any sort of use of force and write reports, I don't think those superiors want to come in and write use of force reports at 2 a.m. all the time. And I think that culturally, there's still a lot of bad apples in the Portland police, but we don't get nearly as many phone calls about police abuse as we used to get 4 or 5 years ago. So I think
so progress is happening
slowly in the Portland police. I do believe that. Yeah, I want to give them credit for that because I think that they culturally have made some changes there. So,
all right, let's get try to get one more phone call in here. Jim, good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, you know, just to piggyback on what that last lady was talking about, I had a friend of mine who's a musician. He's an older man, probably in his 70s. And when I first met him about 10 years ago, he would always be dressed nice coming out to these blues jams, you know. And I always appreciated that because he's pretty old school. His uncle was one of the first recording – his great-uncle was one of the first recording blues artists in the nation. But I always appreciated that about him. But he told me one time, he's like, you know, if I don't come to these blues jams dressed like this, people talk to me disrespectfully. And I was like, well, that okay, you know, I didn't think anything of it. Well, one night he got really relaxed, came in instead of in a three-piece suit with a hat, came in with sneakers, some baggy jeans and a t-shirt, and the people at the gym treated him completely different. Instead of being like, oh, hello, Mr. you know, Mr. Johnson, they were like, yo, what's up, homie, what's up, home slice. And it's like, and it was really like that. I mean, granted, you know, it wasn't like, you know, being discriminatory in a negative way, but it was just, you know, trying to do that pantomiming that a lot of people do when they're trying to seem like they're down, you know?
Listen, I agree with you. I think the basic rule is don't play hip.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, just
you know?
Be who you are. Do not fake it.
Yeah.
Ever.
Yeah, it's... Yeah, and you know, and then I had another friend of mine.
Well, we've actually run out of time. We're on a schedule. I appreciate your call. I'm sorry to have to cut you off, but we do. And I want to thank our guests for being here and for letting us know something that everyone should know.
Well, and thank you, Joe and Abe, for giving more of a platform.
Sure.
I think the more discussions that happen like this are really helpful for our city.
Yep. And Nasriel, well done. Good
thank
luck you. To you.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Yeah, and enjoy your life in college.
Thank you.
All right, we'll be back at you next week. This has been the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Program on KBOO 90.7 FM, your community-supported radio station.
Coming up this morning on KBOO, next at 9 o'clock, it's Alternative Radio, part two of a speech from Reed College in 1995. Howard Zinn in the book that changed the consciousness of a generation, A People's History of the United States. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary, and at 10:15 is Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, Stage and Studio DMAE features the last two shows of Coho Summerfest 2018, Embedded and Phillips Glass Menagerie. And at 11:30, Art Focus welcomes Seminole activist and artist Danny Lyon to talk about his films Willie and Murders, showing this month at the Hollywood Theater. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate.